Good morning. This week's Coral Reef Symposium is wrapping up today. What will the 2,700 scientists take away? We'll talk with some of the key points with the chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy, Hugh Possingham. Meanwhile, there are hot days ahead for Hawaii's kids as delays in the classroom cooling project is put on hold thanks to over-budget bids. We'll talk with Representative Matt Lopresti later this hour.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Most sharks aren't as scary as they're cracked up to be, but there's one species you have every reason to be frightened of. We'll get as close as we dare to the oceanic white-tip shark. And for kids who love theater on Kauai, all the focus is on the next show. We'll check in with Bailey Hutton of the Hawaii Children's Theater.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's Friday, June 24th. The conversation starts right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning, and he did fly away.
Indeed. The great Ralph Stanley. Much missed.
And but there's a lot of good information, though, about him and a lot of just impact that he had over the years with younger generations. So glad at least that we have that, and glad we were able to start with that this morning on a Friday where we have a lot of things to talk about. Thanks very much for joining us for The Conversation this morning. Now, today, the 13th International Coral Reef Symposium comes to an end. As with all conferences, this one will likely finish with calls to action and a renewed commitment to the world's coral reefs. But after the conference high wears off, what are the actions we're most likely to see? Hugh Possingham is the head of the Nature Conservancy. He joins us now with his list of takeaways. Thanks very much for making time for us. You've been very busy this week.
Yes, good morning, Beth Ann.
Yeah. When you assess what this conference means going forward and who was there, there are sort of different populations of people who all came to this, different scientists, different levels. Those, as we've talked about before, policymakers and those scientists who are trying to feed into those policies but who are working in the lab. What was the split? How many people are deeply involved with lab work as opposed to those who are able to influence policy?
Yeah, a lot of the people there are scientists. Their primary reason for waking up in the morning is to go out onto the reef, to go into the lab and work out how it all works. What is the biochemistry of these systems? How are these fish populations functions? So their primary thing is basic science. That would be the majority, 60 or 70%. But then there's a lot of people at this meeting who are from the non-government sector, from the government sector, who are out there communicating with reef managers. Some are reef managers and trying to solve the problems to try and give us happy, healthy reefs into the future.
How well networked are all of these marine systems that we've seen, sort of, especially in the last year, 2 years, coming around the world?
Yeah, this conference is every 4 years, so that's not particularly a great way to network if it's only every 4 years, the big coral reef conference. However, organisations like the Nature Conservancy have a big reef resilience network, which is largely about education, and so they provide online materials, meetings, and ways of reef managers getting a deeper understanding of what is the science they need to manage reefs better, what actions can they take, and how can they form a community of people, a learning community of people. And so there are a lot of places where global experience from the Caribbean to the Great Barrier Reef to the Hawaiian Islands to the West Indian Ocean share their experiences. So it is really now a global family of reef managers and scientists.
According to the Pew Global Oceans Project, there were about 1 million square miles that were protected last year. As 2015 looked to be such a great year for protection, are we now sort of seeing a wave of protection that's moving into areas that we really hadn't seen before?
Definitely. The Convention on Biological Diversity targets asking the countries of the world to conserve 10% of their marine areas is marching ahead, and many countries like Australia fully intend to meet those targets by 2020. So we're seeing a massive expansion of marine protected areas, which is one part of the solution, of course. It's not the entire solution. And the other thing is the work we do is really making sure those protected areas are in the right spot. It's not just a matter of grabbing your pencils and pens and drawing big lines on maps that make everybody happy. It's really about taking all this knowledge and science and trying to understanding of economics and people, because these reserves are just as much for the fishing community as for the tourism community as for the scientists. So bringing all these values together and coming up with reserves that are win-win for everybody.
You're talking about doing a bit of a cost-benefit analysis, it sounds.
Definitely. And the tools that are used to build marine protected areas, like the tool we've developed called Marksan, which does most of the rezoning of marine areas around the planet, has a lot of economics in it. So it's not just a matter of we're building protected areas for nature. It's a matter of saying, let's get a representative sample of the different kinds of habitat, make sure that this protected area system has a bit of every fish population in it, but also in a way that benefits the fishing community, recreational and commercial and artisanal fishing community, as much as possible. So it needs to be well connected. We want those fish in the reserves, which we know get bigger. A big fish that's three times bigger produces about 10 times as many offspring. So these are like fish banks for the fishing industry. But we want to make sure that they then populate the places where the people can fish. So it's basically then a win-win situation for all parts of the community.
Protection is one side of it. Mitigation of the damage already done is another. How are you assessing that as you've had this big conference this week and talked a lot about places in the world that we know have seen serious reef degradation, including the Great Barrier Reef and the Caribbean and even Hanama Bay?
Yeah, the mix of coral bleaching, hurricanes, disease, and things like crown of thorn starfish, which occur in different areas, have degraded reefs quite severely at a global scale, and it's highly variable. And at times, to be honest, there's talk of people getting a bit depressed about the broad backward steps in terms of coral cover and coral reef health. However, people can do what they can do. And so marine reserves are one partial solution to protecting coral reefs, but also there's a lot of other simple things we can do. I think one of the big ones is reducing the sediments and the nutrients that are coming out of urban areas, developed areas and agricultural areas. They pose a severe threat and stress on marine ecosystems, and so managing sediments and soils is something that is also another win-win thing. Nobody wants to see soil go into the sea. It's not good. Nobody wants to see nutrients and toxic things go into the sea. It's not of any benefit to anybody. And so we really need to tighten up on that as much as possible.
When you say tighten up on that, that also goes back to the issue of enforcement. Mm. When you're not supposed to have runoff, when being able to manage that effectively. Mm. In Hawaii, that's been an issue too, as it has been in many places around the world. What do you tell people at this point when you say, you know, that's the one thing that you know that we can do? We might not be able to go in the way back machine and make the world the way it was before all this happened, but you're saying do what we can do, and to be able to do that, how do you engage people successfully when you have development issues?
That's right. Well, I think sometimes we have to legislate. Sometimes we have to tighten up the laws and have to have better enforcement. Sometimes we have to provide incentives. And in the rural community in Australia, there's going to be a lot of incentives for sugarcane growers, graziers to reduce the amount of, change the way they do their farming to reduce the nutrient inputs and stabilise the soils with riparian restoration. Riparian restoration is an easy thing to do that is, again, win-win. So there's things we can do that are beneficial to both the landowners and the reef.
Wish we had more time to talk. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Bethany.
Hugh Possingham is the new chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy.
This is The Conversation on statewide member support at HPR2. It's 8:13. Coming up in the show, just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water, a look at an ocean predator that lives up to its reputation. But first, your quiz.
It's almost Shark Week on TV, but for residents of Hawaii, every week might be a Shark Week. Hawaii is home to approximately 40 distinct species of shark, and they are a common, if sometimes unwelcome, sight for surfers, divers, fishermen, and swimmers. Modern sharks evolved to their present form about 100 million years ago and have become a vital piece of marine ecosystems all over the globe. But shark populations are on the decline, and many species are in danger of extinction in the coming decades. And despite the often heard human disdain for them, their disappearance would have an overwhelmingly negative impact on our ocean's health, according to scientists. There are 8 shark species commonly sighted near Hawaii coastlines. Can you name 4 of them? If you can, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get a right answer will get a T-shirt.
Good morning. I'm Eric Conklin from the Nature Conservancy. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Much of our current fear of sharks comes from a species few people have ever seen, the oceanic white-tip shark, a predator whose population has been depleted almost to extinction by commercial fishing. Michael Dolmeyer, president of the Marine Conservation Science Institute in Waikoloa, has studied their behavior at first hand well enough to know that they live up to their fearsome reputation. His research is part of an upcoming televised Shark Week segment, and he told us what a close encounter with an oceanic white tip can feel like.
My focus in the shark world, and what I'm really well known for, is my work on great white sharks. I've really been able to rewrite what we thought we knew about them by catching large adults and putting long-term satellite transmitters on them. But I moved to Hawaii about 4 years ago, and the oceanic white tip sharks, a shark I've always been fascinated by, but they're really hard to find, which is a bit ironic because at one time they're one of the most abundant sharks in the ocean. And most people have never even heard of an oceanic white-tip shark.
Yeah.
But there were times in our history of mankind when it, in fact, was the deadliest shark on the planet. You know, before naval architecture got to where ships rarely sink, there were, you know, often ships sinking at sea, and we had no weather forecasting, so you couldn't avoid bad storms.
Yeah.
The oceanic white tip was just doing its job, you know, sort of being the garbage man of the ocean.
Right.
Not really a super duper stealthy predator like a great white shark, but they're very good at taking opportunities when they have them. And so, like the USS Indianapolis, a famous case of a ship going down in the Pacific,
yeah.
And many, I forget the number, but it was hundreds of sailors were killed by oceanic white tip sharks. So.
Yeah,
this year I'm shifting some focus to the oceanic white tip, and we did. We filmed the program for Discovery Channel to sort of put them back on the radar. And my main objective is to put them on the radar for conservation purposes because they have by been overfished because they're incidentally caught by longliners that are fishing open ocean for tuna and swordfish. And they have very big fins, and the fins are valuable, so they have been really hit hard. At the same time, you know, I did spend some time in the water with them, and I can say they are still a deadly shark, not one that you think you can just go swimming with if you see it. They can be quite scary.
What's different about their behavior that makes them that way?
They have absolutely no fear. If you go diving on a coral reef, Most sharks you see are going to run away from you. Oceanic white tip, when he sees you, comes right at you and just starts hovering around. And, they just start to wear you down because they don't come in and just bite you. They just start circling and nudging and getting closer and closer, like a vulture just waiting for a weakness.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it's a problem. If you were on a boat that sank, you would eventually start getting tired. And, look, I had a mask on my face. I could see what's going on. I could see them coming. I could kind of poke them in the face or push them away from me.
Yeah.
But if you can't see them, you're in a world of trouble. And so, there are some people in the shark conservation community that try to portray sharks as misunderstood, not dangerous. Well, that's true for the majority of species, but there are a handful that are dangerous, and this is one of them.
And this is something you better know about if you're going to get anywhere around them. What is it about when you say, they're waiting for signs of weakness as you're in the water? Is that things like an irregular rhythm to your movements, the kind that a wounded creature might make?
I don't think that people in the water make the same kind of sound that like a wounded fish would make. So it's hard for me to say. I think they're just waiting to let you stop pushing them off, and they're going to come in and take a little taste. And once that happens, it's all over. There are some dive operators in the world, particularly in the Bahamas, where you can go with them, and they know these sharks very well. And the sharks are somewhat trained. They behave themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got my introduction to oceanic white tips, was in the Bahamas. And it was enjoyable. I did bring another scientist with me. He actually got pretty spooked and got out of the water at one point. But they're a beautiful shark. They're not really a threat to people because they don't live anywhere near the coastline. They like very deep, dark blue water. So although we do get into that kind of water quite quickly in Hawaii, still most people are not swimming, half a mile offshore in Hawaii.
So you'd be far more likely to encounter a reef shark, a tiger shark, one of the
Absolutely.
Other. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the only other one that really worries me in Hawaii is tiger sharks, because they are very coastal. The interesting thing about oceanic white tips in Hawaii is that they have a really unusual association with pilot whales. And I don't know that that's found anywhere else in the world.
Really?
But that's how we eventually found them in Hawaii, is by looking for the pilot whales and jumping in the water with the whales, and then the sharks were often following the whales. So the whales would go by, and then, about a minute and a half later, oceanic white tip would go by. But we had to sort through a lot of pods of whales because even here in Hawaii, the numbers have really been reduced.
Well, that's a shame, and I don't know if everybody understands what the negative impact of losing the majority of the members of a shark species, but it's a serious impact, isn't it?
It sure can be, and in many ways we don't understand it has an ecological effect that in some cases we have noticed, and in other cases that you just don't know what's going to happen. But when you remove a top predator from an ecosystem, then the ecosystem will change. And the best example I can give is the Sea of Cortez, where sharks used to be extremely abundant, and as well as tuna, swordfish, marlin, very healthy ecosystem. But those sharks have been wiped out because of the fin trade. And also in Mexico, they eat sharks. And as a result, there's a species of squid called the genus of Tacitacus, or jumbo squid or Humboldt squid.
Mm-hmm.
And that thing is just taking over the Sea of Cortez now. And they get really big, and they get to be like 100 pounds. And they are super abundant now, voracious predators, and they're changed the entire ecosystem. Because now, even if we tried to let the tuna and marlin and species come back, the tuna and marlin start off as little tiny, 5 millimeter long critters.
Yeah.
But the squid can just devour them when they're that size. And so it's going to be really hard for them to recover.
This is a classic example of an environment thrown out of balance, isn't it?
Exactly. Yep.
Well, it's a great story. I mean, it's the kind of thing that should stimulate lots of further research. There's obviously lots of interesting areas for you yet to explore, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's only a couple of researchers with any dedicated studies to oceanic white tips in the world. Part of the problem is they're hard to find. But but there's another researcher at University of Hawaii, Melanie Hutchinson. She's tagged a couple, not very many. Again, they're just hard to find. And some colleagues of mine in the Bahamas, they have actually quite good access to them there. And I was unable to put a tag on an oceanic white tip during our filming. They were not cooperating. We did find a few, but they were more interested in the pilot whales than they were in taking a bait and getting tagged. So it's still a challenge that I have to meet.
Michael Dohmeyer is the president of the Marine Conservation Science Institute in Waikoloa. His research on oceanic white-tip sharks will be featured on the Deadliest Sharks episode of the Discovery Channel's Shark Week series. It will air next Wednesday, and you can link to more information on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Would you rather be stung by a bullet ant or a Pacific cicada killer wasp? I'm Ira Flatto on Science Friday. Meet the man who sampled and categorized the ouch of messing with the wrong bee. And why would a squid need ink in the darkness of the deep sea? The answer is in our Cephalopod Week wrap-up on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
Imagine digging in your pocket for $9.15 every 60 seconds. Well, $9.15 is what it costs to run the statewide network every minute of every day, and that comes to $13,000 each day, $92,000 a week. These members understand that balancing a budget is important, and we are infinitely grateful for their support. Mi'ai Russell of Honolulu, Judy Walker of Kilauea, and Samoa Lynn of Lahaina. If HPR adds quality to your life, how about becoming a member of HawaiiPublicRadio.org, which is open every minute of every day.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Straub Clinic and Hospital and Gourmet Events Hawaii.
Hawaii has become the first state in the nation to authorize a link of firearm owners to the FBI's database. Those gun control advocates are certainly celebrating Governor Ige's signature on Act 108, but not all are happy with it. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning and Aloha Friday, Beth Ann.
And a good Aloha Friday to you, too. So, obviously, we've seen that at the national level, Congress couldn't do very much on anything meaningful with gun control measures. Look at what happened this week. But in Hawaii, this was very quietly signed into law. What specifically does this mean for anyone who owns a firearm?
So what the FBI has is they have a criminal record monitoring service. It's known as a wrap-back service. And what this law allows for, Hawaii will be the first state to do this, is that if someone is registering their firearm, an individual registering with the state, that information will automatically be sent to the FBI and put in this service. So what will that do? Well, if that person or any person who has a weapon that's registered in the state of Hawaii is arrested anywhere in the country for a criminal offense, we will be notified about that. And then the Hawaii Departments of Police can decide whether that firearm owner should continue to still possess weapon. So really, it's a remarkable step forward. Governor Ige said community safety and responsible gun ownership come first. His attorney general went over the bill very carefully and found that it was legally satisfactory.
National Rifle Association, Hawaii Rifle Association, they're not too happy about this, though. I mean, they're the claims that this is really treading on the Second Amendment.
Right. And of course, these are familiar concerns. Interestingly enough, the local chapter, the HRA, initially testified in support and then later came around when the NRA, which, of course, is a very powerful organization nationally, sent out alerts, veto this bill, you know, let the governor know. But it didn't turn out to be the case. In fact, that bill had very little opposition as it moved through the state legislature, either from the lawmakers who voted on it or other people. Only a handful of people here and there testified against it. A few other departments as well.
And very quickly, what about House Bill 2632 now law?
Well, so there were three bills total signed. The other two, one of them will mean that if a person is a stalker, someone who is a misdemeanor sex assault, they would be disqualified from owning a gun. Gun violence has been linked to domestic abuse. And the other one has to do with surrendering your guns and weapons, your ammo, to police chiefs if you have a background of significant behavioral, emotional, or mental disorders.
And trying to figure out how they're going to figure all of that out is going to be a little bit more challenging. We'll talk to you more about that later on. For the moment, have a good weekend. We'll talk to you next week.
You too. Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat, and he joins us every day with a reality check.
Good morning. It's 8:30, and you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Chris Vandercook. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do that by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Our Facebook page is Hawaii Conversation. On Twitter, we're at HI Conversation. Email is at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
It seems like whatever I'm listening to at the time is my favorite. For instance, yesterday I totally loved a Radiolab story that made me feel like I wasn't alone in the world. Somebody who'd gone through the same things I had. And then I listened to Wait, Wait and had a driveway moment that I just couldn't leave the car.
Aloha, I'm Carol Kahn from Pauilo on the Big Island, and I'm a sustaining member of Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
It's a Friday, which means we read your letters and emails.
The turbocharged dream.
Here's some of what
the
we received
Volkswagen Golf
this week.
GTI.
John Kamali via Facebook on Stopping Rail at Middle Street. What am I going to do at Middle Street when I need to be downtown? Transfer to a bus? Really? This was short-sighted from the beginning. Should have went with a light rail elevated in some areas, ground level in others. The route should have gone from Waianae to Hawaii Kai through downtown, then up Wailea Avenue. If Portland can create a max system under budget and before the due date, we can too. Hire someone from that project.
After my conversation yesterday with researcher Craig Downs about the risk that sunscreen chemicals pose to coral reefs, we got this.
Mahalo for having this interview about sunscreen causing coral to die. An experiment in the Hawaii High School Science Fair proved that most of the common sunscreens kill the native shrimp opai. The teenage scientist discovered that the badger sunscreen does not. Does badger also not cause coral to die? Laura M. Fink.
Well, we asked Craig Downs, and he sent us this response. Relative to other commercial sunscreens, badger products are relatively non-toxic to coral, and we also tested using white shrimp larvae compared to the common aerosol sprays from Ocean Potion or Reef Safe. The acute toxicity, meaning the toxicity you might see from 24 hours to 96 hours exposure, is more likely caused by the preservatives in the products. Many products use parabens or phenoxyl ethanol. Both chemical groups at one time were used as insecticides and so are especially toxic to arthropods like shrimp, but also coral. Most of the products I know of that Badger creates do not use a registered preservative. Instead, they use jojoba oil. Jojoba oil contains a number of natural antifungal antibacterial compounds. These can be toxic to shrimp and coral if exposed at really high concentrations, but compared to the same volume of preservatives used in non-organic products, we don't see a lot of toxicity.
Thanks for the letters. Our talkback line is 808-792-8217, and you can always email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
This year's legislative session ended with lawmakers appropriating $100 million to cool 1,000 classrooms by the end of the year. Now it appears the anticipation of a more educationally friendly climate will be delayed. This week came the announcement that the bids for all the work came in over budget, and the reopening of the bid process won't happen until later this year or perhaps next year. That has one lawmaker steamed. Representative Matt Lopresti is asking the state's AG to look into whether there was gouging. Moreover, he's looking for volunteers and businesses of goodwill to make the project happen with a realistic timeline and at a reasonable cost. Matt Lopresti joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
This has been such a long-anticipated project that for this to come out now, as we're in summer and not even yet the heat of the summer, is very disappointing to many. But did you have any inkling that these bids were coming in over budget before the announcement was made?
No, not at all. I think everybody had anticipated with the estimates from industry ranging between 20 and 40,000 that's precisely what we were going to be getting. However, as reported throughout the media, they came in 4 to 5 times higher than that.
At this point, with these huge bids and with people wondering why, you are also asking that question whether people just saw that there would be a lot of money to be made potentially. But isn't this also being affected by the fact that we have a bit of a construction boom happening?
Well, to some extent, Beth Ann, but the disturbing thing with the price jump is we are the third hottest construction market in the country. We are that now, and we were that a couple months ago when this bill was passed and signed into law and when we got the estimate. So that hasn't changed. Even if you listen to the industry experts like PRP, they even talk about the labor costs, these should be stable. The equipment costs, these are stable. And yet we see these dramatic increases in the bids, and we need to get to the bottom as to why and wherefore those increases.
Have you had some of those conversations with industry? Have you asked them directly why?
Yes, I've spoken with contractors and some of the leaders in the industry, and we're going to be having a meeting to try to get to the bottom of what's going on from their perspective. And at the same time, I'm reaching out with the DOE to find out if there's perhaps simplifications of specs that might be able to be made. Perhaps there's something in the bid or in the RFPs that's driving up the costs that weren't that weren't considered.
Were you able to see the RFPs before they went out?
No, ma'am.
So some of the conversation has been that they're very long, they're lengthy, they're difficult to wade through. Have you seen them since?
I'm trying to get my hands on some of them. And I've spoken with contractors, and I've heard from some that they're upwards of 100 pages. The DOE saying, no, they're not that long, and it's not unusual, the kind of things we've put in. So we're getting very mixed messages from both sides.
And not a lot of clarity.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, and not a lot of clarity to be able to understand why the process might be so fraught and also why the costs were so expanded from what you expected.
Yeah, not yet, but it's just at the beginning by asking the Attorney General to look in. If there is collusion, if there is an attempt to price gouge and to profiteer off the suffering of our children. That's completely unacceptable. If that's happening, the Attorney General needs to look into it and prosecute to the fullest extent of the law. If, however, it's some government incompetence or something that government's doing that's not aware of, that's prohibiting industry from stepping up to where we thought they should step up, then we need to fix that too. Maybe it's a combination of the both. Maybe there's something else that we're missing altogether.
Has the AG given you any response to your request, even candidly?
I can't speak for them. I have spoken with them, and I've corresponded with the Attorney General himself, and they will be. I can't speak for them. It's not my place to speak for them.
So you have no assessment of whether they're willing to take this up and to look into this?
I believe they are. I believe they're willing to look into whether or not there's any wrongdoing. But, again, I can't speak to how they might do that or anything. You'd have to ask them.
And do you have any sense of timeline when they might be willing to talk to you about this?
I know we're going to be in constant contact. I mean, I'm going to be in constant contact with the Attorney General, industry, and the DOE because we need strong leadership to try to help bring everybody to the table. You know, part of the job of legislators isn't just writing laws, but trying to facilitate problem solving between desperate parties. And that's the role that I'm trying to play.
Some would say that could have been avoided if perhaps you'd been able to see this beforehand, or there could have been agreement about how this was going to be put out there. But then again, with the mixed messages, there's, as I say, a lot of misty areas in this. Meanwhile, as you're trying to ferret all of this out, the project is not going to be able to move forward as it was originally anticipated, leaving a lot of kids in a lot of really hot classrooms for a lot longer.
Yeah, and that's the really upsetting and unacceptable part. But we also need to keep in mind that the delay isn't as long as some are reporting. It's for the next fiscal year, which is next month. Those bids are going to go out again, and they should come in shortly thereafter. So it seems at most this might be delayed a few months, not a whole year.
No, not a whole year, but if the,
but,
if the
but
bids go out.
But it would miss the hottest part of the year,
right?
They wanted to get them in before that.
So with some of those bids going out in July, some of the classrooms that may see cooling a little later on this year, what are you doing in terms of your call for, you know, people of goodwill and volunteers and businesses to come forth to try to mitigate this even short term? Have you had any response to that?
Yeah, that's exactly the perfect lead into that, because we can't wait. We can't just wait for reasonable bids, and because the delay in the bidding process to hopefully get reasonable ones. We need people in the community to step up if they have the ability and competence to install split AC or PVAC units, whether they're individuals or they're a contractor willing to donate some of their time to begin to get some of these in before the really hot months come around when the kids are going to be in the classroom. So we're putting the call out, started yesterday, to ask anybody of ability to step up, and they can contact my office at 586-6080 or the Department of Education at 586-3452, the Auxiliary Services Branch, and be happy to get them in a classroom installing this stuff. You know, typically it takes two people one day to install many of these things,
so,
which is really mystifying when you look at some of the bids that talk $100,000.
So
that doesn't add up.
We've got to go in just a second, but Representative Matt Lopresti, did anybody take you up on that offer, and did your phone ring with someone saying, yes, I'd be willing to step up? Have you heard from anybody yet?
Well, like I said, we just put this out yesterday, and it's the beginning of the next day. Not that I know of, but we're hoping to get a lot of phone calls. I've certainly been getting a lot of phone calls from people in the industry and the DOE. Hopefully we'll get some phone calls from some volunteers as well.
We wish you lots of good luck with that. Thanks very much for making time for us this morning.
Thank you for covering this important issue.
Matt Lopresti represents several EVA communities in District 41.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Noheya Gallery, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we asked you to name four of the 10 shark species commonly seen around the coastal waters of Hawaii. Sharks' importance to the ocean is often overlooked. Fear of their presence has led to a disregard for their importance in protecting the importance of protecting shark populations. As an apex predator, sharks are responsible for keeping the marine ecosystem in balance. They remove sick, weak, and old members of fish population, help to keep schools healthy and strong. They even help prevent overgrazing of seagrass. Hawaii is home to dozens of shark species, but only 10 are a common sight. They are Galapagos, White Tip Reef, Black Tip Reef, Gray Reef, Black Reef, Tiger, Sandbar, Scalloped Hammerhead, Smooth Hammerhead, and Big Nose Sharks.
And Andrew Johnston called in from Kalaheo and could name four of that list that you just gave. So he is our winner for today. Thanks very much for calling and playing the Backyard Quiz. Now, if you've got a question for us, we're always hungry for good quizzes. Send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and you just might hear it on a future show.
You don't know what you're capable of until you try. And if there's one important message that comes out of children's theater camps, that's it. Young people who make the leap into theater arts often surprise themselves with capabilities they never knew they had. It's a phenomenon Bailey Hutton has witnessed again and again as program director for Hawaii Children's Theater's Summer Stars, a group of Kauai kids who are about to put on their first show. Bailey's on the line with us now. Good morning, Bailey.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Is that something you see fairly often in your line of work, kids sort of going beyond themselves?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. All the time.
I would think so, but what is it about theater that seems to bring that out?
Well, it's the creative outlet where they have an environment around them that they can really just let their imagination run rampant. I mean, every kid loves to do that, and you have a bunch of kids and adults playing along with you.
What ages are the kids in your program?
The program goes all the way from 5 to 16.
Mm-hmm. And it lasts how long?
It's a 5-week program.
Okay. Well, tell me a little bit about it, Bailey.
So there's actually two different sections of the program. There's the morning program that we call Rising Stars. And that goes from 8 until noon in the morning, and that's more of a instructional, I want to say educational, where the students all rotate around different classes. They'll have a 45-minute rotation in music, dance, and acting, and every week we have a different workshop guest teacher come in and teach something that is their forte. For instance, this week we have Bobby Downs coming in, and she's doing a stage makeup class.
What are some of those others?
Let's see, our first week we had set design by Jarrett Gaines, and last week we had a very cool nonverbal movement communication class by Cher Elwood.
How do the kids take to these classes?
Very well, very well. We make sure that the curriculum reaches just as it would a 16-year-old. We make sure that it can be adaptable to a 5-year-old.
I would imagine that the young kids especially come in sort of not knowing which area of theater they're most interested in. How do you sort of find out where everybody is sort of does their best work?
Oh, it's unique to every individual kid. A lot of kids, you know, they want to be on stage. They're actors. Some kids, you know, they have stage fright. And though this program will help you sort of conquer your stage fright, or at least give you the opportunity to explore that and learn that it's not all that frightening. But for some kids, it's just not for them, and they'd rather get involved in behind the scenes, and we have tons of opportunities for that as well. The kids are allowed to help with tech, with with lighting design, all sorts of areas where they can help backstage as well.
A lot of, you know, full-grown professional actors never quite get over stage fright, and yet they have a lot to offer. And yet there are some who are sort of paralyzed by it and probably shouldn't think about getting on stage. How do you sort of figure out who's who?
Well, I myself have been an actor for about 5 years, and I still get nervous myself before I go on stage. It's just something you learn to control. I don't think you really learn to conquer it, but you learn more about it. You learn how to control it, and you learn how to go through it anyway. And it's always worth it once you're aware and in control of it. And this program, specifically for the children, sort of gives you what's the word? There's no consequences for not going on, you know, so it's a very safe environment for them to explore that fear.
You know, one of the things that I've talked to people, I've dealt with stage fright and been one of those people at various times before, and one of the things that a lot of people say is that if you remind yourself that the audience wants you to succeed, do you think that's an accurate idea?
Absolutely, absolutely. For any show, but specifically this program, absolutely. The audience is there for you and they're supporting you.
So even if you fall, somebody's likely to catch you.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the great thing about acting and improv is you're surrounded by friends on stage that are there to help you out of it if you do get paralyzed, like you said.
What's the length of your program? Roughly 6 weeks from start to finish?
About 5 weeks, actually. So we have 4 weeks of intensive educational value, and then the last week we're actually allowed to move into the venue and they get to rehearse in this theater space on the stage with the stage lights on. It's a great opportunity for them.
Have you been working on the show throughout, or do you just take on the show toward the end of the summer?
No, we rehearse the show, so the afternoon program is more product production oriented. So this year they're doing James and the Giant Peach. And
right.
So for the afternoon from noon till about 5, they'll be rehearsing that show all day long. And then they get to perform it at the end of the program.
How many performers on stage for that show, all told?
Ooh, there's about 50.
Really?
Yeah.
So there's kind of a chorus, or there's some dancers? And
absolutely. There's a lot of ensemble pieces. That's what I love about Hawaii Children's Theater and the shows that we're allowed to pick through this organization is it leaves everyone with a lot of stage time. So there's no particular favorite or one student that's on for the whole show and one that only has, you know, one line. We pick shows where we're allowed to get everyone involved.
How do you find shows like that?
Well, carefully. We have several arrangements with MTI. We get a lot of Broadway junior productions, and we're able to get the rights for those. Yeah.
Junior productions, is that a specific category of shows?
It is, correct. So, for instance, you know, there's a full version of James and the Giant Peach, or a full version of for instance, The Lion King. And by getting the junior version, one, it's condensed, so it doesn't require the full 2 hours and all of the scenery and set design that would go into a full production like that. So it allows us to sort of condense it and be able to actually have a really great final product at the end of the 5 weeks.
So there's a whole sort of, sounds as if there's kind of a national network to provide material to organizations like yours.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Have you seen many alumni of your programs come back and sort of talk about what it did for them?
Absolutely, yeah. So the summer program it kind of has three key parts. And there's the morning program that's generally catered towards a younger audience and those that are just getting involved with the organization. The morning program, the afternoon program, the Summer Star show for this year would be James and the Giant Peach. They have to have a couple years in the morning program before they're allowed to apply for the afternoon program. And then beyond that, the older kids, the Summer Stars alumni, gets to come back and do an after dark production is what we call it. And this year they're doing Monty Python's Spamalot.
And I assume they all are capable of working pretty hard on these shows, Bailey.
Absolutely. So the fun part and can be the stressful part about the summer is you only have a very limited amount of time to put this show on. So everyone works very hard. Spamalot's rehearsing, I think, 4 nights a week. So it definitely takes a lot of commitment to follow through.
Well, it'll be. We'll want to keep an eye on that. Thanks a lot for talking to us, Bailey.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Sure. Bailey Hutton is the program director and PM stage manager for Hawaii Children's Theater's Summer Stars, which will put on a production of James and the Giant Peach Jr. the weekend of July 8th at the Kauai Community College Performing Arts Center. And you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
For the first time, Kuana Torres Kahele and various hula hala will be performing the new music he has created for the Hawaiian Islands across two back-to-back concerts. This year's HPR Palikū Theater event on August 7th gives you the choice of an afternoon or an evening performance, or choose both and enjoy a mini luau between shows. Please go to events on hawaiipublicradio.org for more. Kuana Torres Kahele, August 7th at the Palikū Theater.
It has been a hectic time for business owners across the UK thinking about what is next for their bottom line.
We offer luxury clothing at an accessible price point, and we would no longer be able to do so, I don't think. My business would probably be gone after a few months.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The fallout, whatever it is, from the Brexit vote, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, following On the Media.
Beth Ann, elected officials have been very fond of talking to us about how society's problems can be solved by public-private partnerships, and that business and industry will work hand-in-hand with government to solve pressing problems. It doesn't seem to have quite worked out that way in the problem of cooling our classrooms, at least not so far.
Not so far, and the reasons for all of that are, in some cases, yet to be known. But the bottom line of it is it's hot and it's going to get hotter. And whether there will be people of goodwill who will say, yeah, we can do something about this and we can do it at a reasonable price point and make it happen fairly quickly before we hit the true heat of summer and we get into August and September. And, the classrooms are like a sauna. Well, we'll see if those people are yet to be found.
It's certainly been an ongoing concern for decades now.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people were saying enough and thought that, that happened with the legislature approving so much money to go into cooling the classrooms. But we see where we are right now.
Yeah, not yet.
Not yet. Exactly. But at this moment, we need to say goodbye because the weekend's coming. It's a Friday and it's almost 9 o'clock. Coming next week, we're going to talk about a long-term action lawsuit, a class action lawsuit that a lot of people may or may not know about regarding special education.
And love basketball and Aristophanes at Manoa Valley Theater.
We like to hear from you. You can call the Talk Back line to let us know your thoughts anytime you like. 808-792-8217 is the number. Talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org is our email. Our Facebook page is Hawaii Conversation, and we tweet at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
If you like the music you hear on the show, you can find our playlist on our page at hawaiipublicradio.org, which is where you can also listen back to today's show. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants, and our summer intern is Paul Marto Pinto.
The Backyard Quiz theme is written by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. See you Monday for The Conversation.